Beyond Barbarossa, Episode 96, Silesia, Part 1. Welcome to Episode 96, Silesia, Part 1 of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English-language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Murray, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio on the unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe people, also called Ottawa, capital of the free, sovereign, independent Canada. Today, I'm joined in the Redbeard Studio by my indispensable assistant, Ragnar, the magnificent ragdoll cat. Say hello, Ragnar. Yeah, he doesn't say a lot. Before I go on, I want to remind you that Patreon supporters get early ad-free and video episodes. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa to sign up at any level. In this episode, we have some serious catching up to do. The previous three were a mini-series about the Yalta Conference of February 1945, and I'm very happy and thankful to be joined by author and historian Giles Milton for the second two of those episodes. Now I'm recording this episode in early March 2026, and as you know, we're trying to roughly track the progress of the war on the Eastern Front with an 81-year delay, which means we should be covering March 1945. So we have to back up a bit to February 1945, when the big three Allied leaders, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, talked and feasted in the former imperial resort of Yalta in the Crimea. As they did that, the war, of course, went on. Major events at this time were coming faster and faster, closer together, and even more significant every time. So, this episode is going to go over some of the highlights of February and the first part of March 1945. Just a bit of a warning, I'm going to be using two names for a lot of places, such as Lauban, Luban. This is because, for all of this episode, the fighting is happening in areas that were part of Germany before the Second World War and are now part of Poland. So the names of a lot of places, like Breslau, changed to Wrocław and so on. Just a bit of a word of warning and also a quick apology. I find Polish, strangely enough, about the hardest language to pronounce. So my apologies to all my Polish-speaking listeners out there. Strap in, because there's a lot going on everywhere in the war. Since the autumn of 1944, Germany has been losing allies, or puppets. By 1945, once neutral countries were beginning to make their opposition to the Nazi regime, the Reich, vocal, if a little disingenuous. Romania and Bulgaria switched their loyalty from the Axis to the Allies in September 1944. In February 1945, Ecuador, Paraguay, Peru, Venezuela, Uruguay, and finally Argentina declared war on Germany and Japan. This meant that every country and colony in South America was formally, if not genuinely, at war with the Axis, except for Chile, which had broken ties with Germany in 1943. Later in the month, Egypt and then Turkey, Syria, and Lebanon declared war on the Axis. Saudi Arabia joined the gang on 1st March. In the Pacific, at the beginning of February, U.S. and Filipino forces entered Manila, capital of the Philippines. The occupying Japanese responded by massacring over 100,000 civilians in the city. 2 weeks later, 16 February, the Second Battle of Corregidor began in earnest after weeks of aerial and naval bombardment. Paratroopers from the U.S. Army landed at the high point of the rock, while an amphibious attack landed on the beaches. On the 19th of February, U.S. Marines landed on the island of Iwo Jima, starting a battle that culminated in the most iconic photograph of the Pacific War on the 23rd. By 3rd March, U.S. and Philippine forces finished liberating Manila, driving the Japanese occupiers out. That same day, British General Bill Slim's 14th Army overwhelmed Japanese forces at the Irrawaddy River in Burma, opening the road to Rangoon. On the 9th, U.S. Army Air Force conducted Operation Meeting House, firebombing Tokyo and causing huge civilian casualties. The same day, the Japanese in Vietnam took out the Vichy French government and proclaimed Bao Dai as the Emperor of Vietnam. This empire would not last 6 months. On the 10th, Japanese balloon bombs fell on Washington State, slightly damaging the Hanford site, part of the Manhattan Project that produced plutonium used in the atomic bomb. The next day, the 11th, hundreds of U.S. B-29s firebombed Nagoya, Japan. And on 20 March, the Indian 19th Army Division liberated Mandalay, Burma. In Western Europe, 9th February, the French First Army eliminates the Colmar Pocket, the last German foothold west of the Rhine River in central Alsace. This is after the end of the Battle of the Bulge in December 1944 and January 1945. On the night of 13 to 14 February, UK and US air forces drop 3,900 tons of high explosive and incendiary bombs on Dresden, Saxony. It causes a legendary firestorm that kills 25,000 people, mostly civilians, and destroys the historic city center. Also on 14 February, the U.S. Army Air Force bombed Prague because of a navigation error. They were supposedly on their way to Dresden. This killed over 700 civilians and wounded another 1,100. On the 21st February, Brazilian and U.S. forces defeated German defenders at Monte Castello in northern Italy. On 7th March, the U.S. First Army approached the Rhine River and realized that the Ludendorff Bridge over the Rhine River at Remagen, Germany, was intact. The German attempt to destroy the bridge failed, so the Americans charged ahead and made their first bridgehead over the Great River. This allowed them to capture Cologne on the eastern side of the Rhine. For the next 2 weeks, the Germans tried repeatedly to destroy the bridge, even using V-2 rockets, which missed. The closest hit was 300 meters from the bridge and killed a number of German civilians. Until finally, the combination of air and artillery bombing, demolition attempts, and wear and tear caused the Ludendorff Bridge to collapse on 17th March, killing 28 U.S. Army engineers. However, by this time, the Allies were well and truly on the eastern side of the Rhine and were moving on Bonn and other major cities. As described in episode 92, the Red Army captured the Hungarian capital of Budapest by 13th February after a 50-day siege and a grinding, slow squeeze by the Red Army. 30,000 German and Hungarian soldiers were killed in the siege itself, and over 100,000 more in Hungary between November 1944 and February 1945. The Red Army paid a higher price for this victory, as many as 160,000 dead, plus another 240,000 wounded and sick in the siege of Budapest alone. By the beginning of February, the Red Army was operating on German soil, not just in the territory the Nazis had seized from other countries starting in 1939, but pre-war German territory. As described in previous episodes, the Red Army had swept into East Prussia in January 1945, confining diminishing German forces in shrinking pockets against the Baltic Sea. By that point, the Soviets had also conquered Poland. Notice I did not say liberated, after the Germans had all but obliterated Warsaw. Farther south, the Red Army had swept through Slovakia and most of Hungary. And as described in episode 92, Ivan Konev's first Ukrainian front had reached the Oder River, which today forms a large part of the modern Polish-German border. Konev's forces had established bridgeheads over the Oder at towns called Steinau, now called Szczynawa in Poland, and Olow, now Olava, Poland. Steinau, Szczynawa is about 40 kilometers northwest of Breslau, the regional capital, now called Wrocław, Poland. Olow, or Olava, is about 20 kilometers southeast of Breslau. In effect, Konev had bracketed this important city. So then, in February, Konev received orders from Stavka, the Soviet High Military Command, to strike into Germany, specifically the area called Silesia. Thus, on 8 February, while the Soviet, British, and American leaders were still noshing and yakking in a former imperial spa, Ivan Konev launched the Lower Silesian Offensive. We'll talk about that right after this break. Hi, Scott here. I hope you enjoy this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating and or a review on whichever platform you listen to it. That helps let other people know about it and find it more easily. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you prefer. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes. Check it out, won't you? Won't hurt. Patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome to the second segment of episode 96 of Beyond Barbarossa. We're focusing now on the Red Army's Lower Silesian Offensive. Now, to orient you geographically, Silesia is an area along the Oder River, which flows from what's now Czechia, or the Czech Republic, north to empty into the Baltic Sea. Thus, Upper Silesia is farther south, and Lower Silesia farther north. Silesia was a critical industrial heartland in pre-war and wartime Germany. In the words of Evan Maudsley in his book Thunder in the East, the Nazi-Soviet War 1941-1945, unlike the Ruhr in western Germany, Silesia was distant from Allied bomber bases in Britain and Italy. Silesia was a kind of German Urals, a region to which the war factories and population of the Reich had been evacuated. The population of Breslau, the main town, had risen to over 1 million people by 1945. Stalin, a veteran industrializer, was keenly aware of the region's resources. He described them as gold to Marshal Konev, and he ordered him to encircle manufacturing and mining districts and capture them intact rather than plow through them. End quote. So you can see why this area, Silesia, was important to both Germany and the USSR. At this point, February 1945, the first Ukrainian front, Konev's command, had six armies, and he arranged them at the two bridgeheads we talked about. At the Steinau or Szczynawa bridgehead were the 3rd Guard Tank Army, the 3rd Guards Tank Army, the 3rd Guards Army, the 6th Army, the 4th Tank Army, and the 52nd Army. And farther south, at the Olow or Olava bridgehead, the 5th Guards Army, and the 2nd Air Army. You can see this in map 2 for the webpage for this episode. Facing them, it's impossible to find real numbers of the defenders of the Germans. And yes, they are defenders. This was pre-war Germany. Officially opposing the Soviet advance into Silesia was the northern wing of Army Group A, redesignated at this point roughly to Army Group Center, commanded by Field Marshal Ferdinand Schirner. I'm going to quote another book, friend of the podcast, Anthony Tucker Jones, Slaughter on the Eastern Front, Hitler and Stalin's War, 1941 to 1945. To defend the vital industrial resources of Upper Silesia, Hitler would have needed a minimum of 12 divisions, end quote. And by that, I think he meant 12 full-strength divisions of up to 20,000 men each. The Germans just did not have these. Field Marshal Schirner had what was left of the 17th Army. These were the 48th and 56th Panzer Corps, the 17th and 8th Corps, and the garrison of Breslau. So maybe 7 divisions. And he also had the 4th Panzer Army. This is the same bunch that used to be commanded by Hermann Hoth and had driven to the slopes of the Caucasus Mountains and tried then failed to relieve the 6th Army at Stalingrad. Now the 4th Panzer Army was under the command of General Fritz Huber Grauser, and it included 3 Panzer Corps, the 24th, 40th, and the famous Grossdeutschland Panzer Corps. There was also a thrown-together battle group called Gruppe Friedrich. Now, a word about Breslau, the city at the center of this offensive. And you probably guessed it would be another fortress city, a festung. The idea was the German forces there were to hold it against everything that the Soviets threw at it, no matter what. What this amounted to was the forces there would fight on until they were all dead. We've seen this how many times in this podcast alone? Warsaw, Budapest, Posen, Stalingrad. You'd think the German general staff would have learned that this tactic doesn't work. It only wastes lives and materiel. Of course, yes, we all know, they did know that. But Adolf Hitler would not admit it. And every general did know something else, that contradicting the Führer would only result in one more German death, his own. The civilians could act a little bit more realistically. As the Red Armies kept coming westward, people left their homes and retreated toward the center of Germany. Officials estimated that some 4 million were fleeing East Prussia and Silesia at the end of January. By mid-February, the number of people moving deeper into the shrinking Reich was over 8 million. On the morning of 8 February, Konev's 1st Ukrainian Front launched a 50-minute artillery bombardment from their bridgeheads at Steinau, northwest of Breslau, and Olau, southeast. Then the Red Army's troops and tanks began moving at 0600, advancing up to 60 kilometers or 40 miles by the end of the day. By 10th February, 2 days later, the 4th Tank Army had made 60 miles or 100 kilometers. From the Steinau bridgehead, the Red 6th Army turned hard left, south and east, back toward Breslau from the west, while part of the 5th Guards Army came up from the southeast. The two forces met in the night of 12th to 13th February, trapping 200,000 civilians and 40,000 Fortress Breslau troops in the city. The siege of Breslau began on 13th February as more and more Red Army units joined the encirclement. That night, the 19th Panzer Division, part of the 40th Panzer Corps, counterattacked, opening a corridor that allowed many of the civilians to escape. Some made it to Dresden, and you history buffs know it was being firebombed that very night. The remaining 100,000 or so civilians, including inmates of local prisons and concentration camps, were forced to build defenses. To quote Antony Beevor in the Second World War, "The siege of Breslau was organized by the fanatical Gauleiter Karl Hanke, who ruled by terror, executing soldiers and forcing civilians, including children, to clear a runway under heavy Soviet fire." End quote. Many more civilians were killed in the crossfire and bombardments. The siege lasted until the end of the war in May, so we'll come back to this hapless city. Now, while this siege is going on, The rest of Konev's first Ukrainian front was continuing westward. On 14 February, the Grossdeutschland and 24th Panzer Corps counterattacked the 4th Tank Army as it was approaching the next major objective, the Nysa River. However, the Germans, even these vaunted units, could not complete an encirclement of the 4th Tank Army. They gave up the attack or counterattack after 5 days when two more Red Armies arrived to protect the 4th Tank Army's flanks. On 18 February, the 8th Panzer Division made a surprise attack against the southern wing of the Soviet advance. Heavy fighting slowed the Soviets, but by 28 February, the 3rd Guards Tank Army took the city of Lauban, now Lubin, Poland, 150 kilometers from Breslau/Wrocław in 2 weeks. 150 kilometers. By the 24th of February, Konev's forces had taken a small bridgehead over the Nysa River at the town of Forst, also called Lausitz and Barsk, which is now right on the German-Polish border. Konev decided this was a good time to suspend operations there because he was turning his attention southward to his next operation into Upper Silesia. We'll get to that next episode. That also makes it a good point to shift our attention north, because 24th February 1945, the day that Konev suspended his Lower Silesian operation, was the beginning of the East Pomeranian Strategic Offensive Operation by the Red Army. Back in January, in episode 92, we left our old friend Konstantin Rokossovsky in East Prussia, where his 2nd Belorussian Front had trapped the Germans in shrinking pockets against the Baltic Sea. At the same time, the 1st Belorussian Front, commanded by Stalin's most ruthless marshal, Georgi Zhukov, was advancing through East Prussia and into Pomerania, heading straight for Berlin. On 15 February, the Germans launched a counteroffensive on the flanks of the advancing Red Armies east of the Oder River in order to try to blunt this advance. General Hurrying Heinz Guderian, remember him? Hitler had fired him after the Battle of Moscow in 1941, then appointed him to a makework position called Inspector General of Armies after the German loss at Stalingrad. So he's back. During this time, Guderian actually had some productive work. He actually had some input into the development and production of Tiger II and Panther tanks. By the winter of 1945, he's back in planning mode, and he tells Hitler that he advises a counterattack in order to blunt Zhukov's drive toward the capital. This he called Operation Solstice. Guderian's idea for Operation Solstice was to withdraw all the German troops that were still in the Courland pocket in Latvia, covered in episode 86, along with the occupation troops in Norway. He also wanted to divert units from operations that were still being planned in Hungary. However, Hitler insisted that Courland and Norway had to be held, and that operations in Hungary must continue. So what Guderian got was the 11th SS Panzer Army. It existed more on Heinrich Himmler's organizational chart than it did in reality. On paper, it consisted of 3 army corps and supposedly 1,200 tanks. But there were no trains available to transport these tanks to where Guderian wanted them. Plus, all the forces for the 11th SS Panzer Army had only 3 days' worth of ammunition and fuel. What they ended up bringing to this operation were 104 Panzer IV tanks, 12 Tiger tanks, and 127 of the new Panther tanks, as well as 96 tank destroyers. Sounds pretty good. As far as personnel go, on paper again, this should have been over 100,000 men. The real numbers were a fraction of the figures the commander saw on paper, and a larger proportion of them were Volkssturm. These are poorly trained civilian militia dredged up from the whatever civilians were still in those areas. And Hitler Youth. Yes, children. Child soldiers. On the other hand, the Soviet 1st and 2nd Belorussian fronts also had lost heavily in the previous few months. Even so, the target of this operation, the 1st Belorussian Front, consisted of 5 armies. Even after all the casualties they had suffered, there were still probably 500,000 men. Against these odds, the 3rd SS Panzer Corps attacked south of Stettin, now Szczecin, on the mouth of the Oder River on 16 February, driving the Soviets back as far as 12 kilometers. Then its commander, General Wenck, remember that name for the future, was seriously injured in a car crash on 17 February, and the initiative stalled. The Soviet 3rd Shock Army counterattacked, stopping the German drive. On the 19th, the Red 61st and 2nd Guards Tank Armies and the 7th Guards Cavalry Corps attempted to capture Stettin, or Szczecin. They got bogged down in street fighting in the suburbs. The Germans called off the operation and withdrew deeper into Germany. There were now more pockets of Germans clinging to a bit of land along the Baltic coast from Kolberg to Stettin. As for the Soviets, they decided to postpone the final drive for Berlin until they finished securing East Pomerania, Silesia, and Hungary. The task of securing East Pomerania fell to Rocky Rokossovsky and his 2nd Belorussian Front, along with 3 armies from Zhukov's 1st Belorussian Front. These were the 1st and 2nd Guards Tank Armies and the 3rd Shock Army. In total, Rokossovsky had at his command nearly 1,000,000 men, and they were moving on a depleted German force, Army Group Vistula. Units on paper included 2 panzer corps and 3 infantry corps, but in reality, these were units composed of the survivors of once powerful formations, thrown together as best they could, with diminishing supplies of ammunition and fuel. Rokossovsky launched his attack on 24th February, as I mentioned, the same day that Konev paused his Lower Silesian offensive. Rokossovsky's forces advanced 20 kilometers or 12 miles before they met intense resistance and had to stop. On 26 February, Rocky threw in the 3rd Guards Tank Corps, which made it another 40 kilometers or 25 miles. By 2nd March, they had cut off the German 2nd Army near Koslin, now Kozalin, on the Baltic Sea coast. You can see all this on Map 3. On 1st March, units from the 1st Belorussian Front struck northward, pushing the Germans back towards Stettin, Szczecin. By the 4th, the Red Army was on the seacoast. The German units encircled. What was left of the German 2nd Army retreated toward Danzig or Gdansk, and the 3rd Panzer Army toward Dramberg or Droskow. That was Phase 1 of Rokossovsky's East Pomeranian Offensive. Phase 2 began on 6 March, with the 2nd Shock Army advancing on the historic Teutonic Order castle of Marienburg, now Malbork. The Germans uncharacteristically evacuated it on the 8th of March. Go figure. By the 9th, the Soviets were besieging the German 2nd Army in Danzig, and the 1st Belorussian Front was driving the remaining 3rd Panzer Army out of the right bank or eastern side of the Lower Oder River. And now we get back to the familiar story of the Festungs. Kolberg on the Baltic, west of Danzig or Gdansk, was designated a fortress city on 4th March. So just like it wasn't, and now it is. Thanks. The idea was it could be used to bring in reinforcements and supplies by sea. The garrison there numbered between 8,000 and 15,000. It's vague. It's impossible to know at this point how many were even able to lift a gun to their shoulder. Rokossovsky sent the 272nd Rifle Division, the 45th Tank Brigade, and 3 divisions of the 1st Polish Army into this. The 1st Polish Army was also known as Berling's Army, comprising ethnic Poles who were actually fully communist and controlled by Moscow. So in all, over 28,000 troops. So this is up to 4 times the strength of the German garrison in the city. The fighting began in earnest on 4th March, and the Germans repulsed multiple attacks. By the 12th, the Soviets sent in heavy tanks, artillery, and Katyusha rocket launchers. By the 16th, the Germans had to fall back to only the port of the city and began evacuating. The German Navy, the Kriegsmarine, evacuated about 70,000 civilians, including refugees from the surrounding area, and about 40,000 soldiers, leaving behind 2,000 to cover their escape. The Soviets finally captured the city on the 8th, taking those 2,000 soldiers prisoner. 2 full weeks of heavy fighting had destroyed 80% of the buildings in the city. German losses in Kolberg are not known. The Soviets lost 1,206 killed and 3,000 wounded just in this city. The next target for the Red Armies was Danzig. Let's take one more short break before we get to that.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War, with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Halba Pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen, many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold. Until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front, and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
We're back for the final segment of episode 96 of Beyond Barbarossa, Silesia, part 1. And for this segment of the podcast, I'm joined by my other stalwart assistant, Daisy the Danger Doodle. Say hi, Daisy. She's too tired. On 15 March, the 49th and 70th Red Armies drove toward the town of Sopot, now Sopot, on the Gulf of Danzig, just north of the larger city. 4 days of heavy fighting between the two Red Armies and the Arponas, the 4th Panzer Division, brought the Soviets to the outskirts of Sopot. On 22nd March, the 70th Red Army reached the seacoast, splitting the German defense of the area. The Soviets conquered Danzig itself on 30th March, leaving remaining defenders in yet another pocket on a narrow spit of land called the Hel Peninsula. This battle cost the Germans another 39,000 dead and 10,000 captured. In all, the East Pomeranian offensive resulted in over 230,000 Soviet and Polish military casualties, including 55,000 dead or missing. German losses are hard to find, but we do know that in January alone, the Germans lost close to 200,000 soldiers dead on the Eastern Front. Each loss was more expensive than the previous one, as Germany could no longer replace any losses of men. The Volkssturm and Hitler Youth fighters on the front became more and more prominent, a greater portion of the defenders, as the professional soldiers were systematically eliminated. Look at maps 4A and B to see just how much territory the Germans were losing in this month alone. The Reich was being erased on the west, south, and east faster and faster. And Zhukov was on the Eastern Front, itching to take his first Belorussian front straight to Berlin. But first, the Soviet high command knew they had to secure their southern flank, meaning Upper Silesia and Hungary. So that's where this podcast is going next episode. Until then, thank you for listening to this episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. As always, there are pictures and maps on the webpage for this episode, number 96, which you can find at beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. If you like this episode, please click that follow or subscribe button on your podcatching app. And if you have a couple of minutes, please consider leaving a review. Those help other people who are interested in this part of history find the show. Do you have a question, a comment, a correction, just something to say? Don't wait. Send me an email, scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca. You can also leave your thoughts on the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. And you can find me, Scott Burry, author, on Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky. I want to say a special thank you to everyone who supports the podcast through Patreon, including the newest supporters, Will Baker, Scott Callender, T.E. Colenda, and Robert McKinney. Remember, Patreon supporters get episodes early, ad-free, and with images. Until all Ukrainian refugees can return home safely, your financial support goes to charities that help Ukrainian refugees. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina. Viva Canada.